Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.
Thanks again for joining us here in Circles of Change, and a fellow Midwesterner that I have in the studio, Dr. Joseph Chambers from Carondelet Health Network. How are you today?
Laura, I'm doing just fantastic.
Terrific. Well, let me tell you, we've got a native of Chicago, Illinois, the state where then Dr. Chambers remained for undergraduate studies in biology through medical school before going to Baylor in Houston, Texas for his residency in adult internal medicine. He followed them with a cardiology fellowship at the Texas Heart Institute. Joseph's professional activities since 1995 included over 15 years of interventional cardiology and peripheral vascular services in the state of Kansas and Arizona, academic appointments as a clinical assistant professor at the University of Kansas, and also adjunct faculty for Wichita State University. He's been vice chair of cardiology section for a medical center, co-vice chairman of a medical center investigational review board, plus given of his time to medical professional associations and foundations. And in his spare time, this is a classic, isn't it, that Joseph co-hosted a weekly radio and television program on cardiovascular health. So he's going to be a natural with me here today in the studio. In 2005, he relocated to Tucson with Southwest Heart in the Carondelet Health Network, providing consultative, invasive, and interventional cardiology and peripheral vascular services. He's active in many subcommittees at Carondelet's St. Joseph Hospital, and now in his spare time, he'd rather be called Daddy by his 2.5-year-old daughter, plus enjoys skiing, music, reading, and cooking. So again, welcome to Tucson and what you do here for our community.
Glad to be here. It's interesting to hear all of that. I always feel so much older.
He's a kid, by the way. An absolute kid. Well, heart disease, it's not something just for older people, right?
It really isn't. And that's kind of the old fallacy out there. We used to think that heart disease was something that affected older people. We think of our grandparents and so forth. But it really does start young, and we need to grab on to that point that it's a disease that starts very early. We have an opportunity to intervene in that early on to prevent it from progressing.
Right. And so, you know, if you think about it for us in the medical care system as it is, that we have a general practitioner or a family practice doctor we go to. And do you feel that those professions are picking up on a lot more of the signals that those of you that are specialists would know how to see? In other words, when do I know it's time for me to really search out even maybe a cardiologist as my primary care physician to balance out the other things I search for gait checks on?
I think that's actually one of the unique challenges that most of us face, because we don't know. We depend very heavily on whoever our health providers are to make that right decision. I always like to empower people to realize that you're really just not stuck. And if you have symptoms that are suggestive of a problem and you don't feel that you've had a satisfactory answer from whomever you see, get another opinion.
So for heart disease, the symptoms, give us 101.
Heart disease is pretty tricky. We think of kind of the classic Sanford and Son, where Red Fox, you know, grabs his chest and says, "Elizabeth, I'm coming to join you." I mean, that's kind of a dramatic presentation, and often it's the case for men. Chest heaviness, tightness, a pressure sensation. There may be breaking into a sweat or radiation to a jaw or teeth, even to the earlobes. In women, it tends to be a bit more insidious. Women may not have any symptoms at all. Probably 40% or so of women, the first symptom they ever receive of underlying heart disease is sudden death.
Oh, my.
And they meet me during CPR.
Yeah.
Women, it may be something as subtle as all of a sudden the things that one could do, I can't do it anymore. The stairs that I used to be able to go up or being able to exert myself at the gym, all of a sudden I'm just getting a little bit winded when I do things. You know, it's interesting that women, although they tend to present with very atypical presentations, and we all know it, women tend to not be taken as seriously and are not treated as aggressively as men.
Yeah, in other words, you can't possibly be having a heart attack.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
First of all, you're a woman, and you know I've been in practice for long enough that I have horror stories, including when I was in training. We used to have this horrible thought that if you were a young Hispanic female who presented with chest pain under the age of 50, it was considered hysteria.
Or just acid reflux from something that you ate.
Absolutely. We now know that heart disease is actually pretty common, and for a lot of patients may present itself in the third decade, the fourth, certainly the fifth decades and beyond.
Well, and in fact, I think some of the statistics are really striking on the number of, well, I even said in that introduction that heart disease actually takes more women's lives than all of the cancers and diabetes combined.
It does. It still is very sobering when I consider women's health in itself. Most women who I've spoken to professionally, their greatest concern is of breast cancer,
right?
Cervical, uterine, and so forth. Breast cancer will probably affect about 1 in 7 women. However, 1 in 2 women will develop heart disease. And in the United States alone, although this is a global epidemic, probably every 10 seconds a woman dies of a heart attack. Every 10 seconds.
Wow. 1 in 2 suffer with heart disease. And so the campaign for the Go Red for Women campaign and the kind of things you folks do at Carondelet, how is it that statistic is not known?
Well,
I mean, it's just so striking. 1 in 2, that tells me a tremendous amount of insight.
Education plays a big role. I think the American Heart Association has done a really good role over the last years, and big health organizations such as Carondelet in the education process. I guess probably as early as 2004, women interviewed about things like heart disease. I say at that point, only about 50% of women, this is 2004, who were queried on what would you do if you thought you had a heart attack. Maybe 50% said they would dial 911. Most said things like, oh, I'd probably call my son or my daughter or my husband as the first thing. And time is critical. So education is a real big deal. The numbers have gotten better. It used to be that there was probably 10 out of, maybe 100,000 women would die from heart disease. And the numbers steadily got better and better. But now they're getting worse. And it's primarily because we've gotten fat.
I was going to ask you, talk about the linkages to obesity.
Obesity is a really big deal, I think, on twofold. One, it does sort of, it accelerates some of the other risk factors. It increases the risk of diabetes. Diabetes in itself is alone a heart disease equivalent. So if you have diabetes, you essentially have coronary artery disease.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes it more difficult to regulate blood pressure. It makes it more difficult to regulate cholesterol. All of those are individual risk factors, but combined, it's not just having two risk factors, it increases the risk exponentially. Here's one example. If we look at what we consider to have normal blood pressure, less than 140 over 90 in most patients, even at a normal blood pressure, quote-unquote, the risk of heart disease, probably about 2% for most Americans. But incrementally, as it increases, the number just swings up incredibly.
Yeah.
So a modest elevation in blood pressure plus a modest elevation in cholesterol untreated, modest poor control of diabetes, and then my favorite pet peeve, cigarette smoking, you're doomed.
Yeah, absolutely. Cigarette smoking, and then is there not also a role of alcohol in the mix?
Well, alcohol has certainly been under many controversies. In years past, we fell down the path of feeling that there were some protective benefits to certain alcohol components. I think it depends on what you read. I think in moderation, but patients often ask, what is moderation? And who knows? I don't know what moderation is.
Well, the other thing is that the alcohol, though, can be paired with a certain lifestyle as opposed to one that would be more active with preventative action like exercise or being mindful of, you know, somehow drinking that glass of wine prompts me to eat a lot more saltier foods or sweet foods. So that right there tells me, wait a minute, there's an unintended consequence of that.
No, I think you're right. I think the combination of things that goes along with moderation of alcohol is really a key. And then, of course, the other component of that being such an enormous caloric content
that's
to any alcohol, it's essentially unusable energy stores that increases the risk.
Well, you had mentioned in your list of anchoring points you want to make sure that we cover. One, you said the definite things that don't work in prevention.
Yes. You know, there are many of us who, especially in women, but men too, who have this denial component that, well, I don't have to worry about heart disease because I don't smoke and I'm doing these other things. And a number of those things involve naturopathic methods. Mm-hmm. In years past, we felt that estrogen compounds were a savior for women because it was suggested that the estrogen might actually increase the good protective cholesterol. And that turned out to be false. It actually increased death rates associated with heart disease and some other things. But also along with that are a number of supplements. I digress a little bit. The bad cholesterol, we refer to it as LDL cholesterol. When the bad cholesterol enters the body, it changes. It becomes oxidized. And it's that oxidized LDL that sort of diffuses into the walls of the arteries and starts this great big disease process. Well, that in itself set up this whole wave that maybe antioxidants might be beneficial. And so there are a lot of them. So things like beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E.
Cassia, blueberries, you know, the
absolutely.
Other things, yeah.
A lot of those just didn't work. And in particular, the beta-carotene, the C, and the E, those antioxidant compounds were studied. And it turns out there not only was not an incremental benefit, but there was also some potential harm. So for women, but also in men, antioxidants for primary prevention of heart disease, it doesn't work. The other fallacy relates to aspirin. There's a lot of great benefits from aspirin. Most of the clinical trials involving aspirin involved women. Aspirin to prevent coronary heart disease in a woman under the age of 65 who does not have diabetes, who does not have overt evidence of heart disease, documented coronary disease, probably does not add much benefit incrementally. So taking that aspirin, if you're a woman under the age of 65 without diabetes, probably doesn't protect you. On the other hand, if you have documented coronary disease, of which diabetes mellitus is an equivalent, or you've had heart disease, or you're a man, it absolutely does confer benefit.
Well, if I don't know all that real profile of who I am inside every nook and cranny, it can't hurt to take that aspirin.
Probably not. I mean, there's a lot of great benefits with aspirin and how it affects the sticky part of blood we call the platelet. The platelet is kind of the part of heart disease that's really not our friend. I mean, if we get a cut or something, we do want to be able to stop the bleeding. But the genesis of the traditional heart attack is some narrowing exists inside a blood vessel. And these plaques are angry. At some point in time, it ruptures. It breaks open. The body interprets that as, oh, look, I'm bleeding. So it rushes the platelets over the sticky part to stop the bleeding. Clot begets clot. And before you know it, the vessel has become completely occluded or blocked. And aspirin a day, in general, helps prevent the clots, the platelets, from being sticky. So in the event that you're one of the unfortunate one every minute who has an event, the platelets are less apt to become sticky, to form clot, to restore blood flow. But it does depend on recognizing symptoms and immediately being smart enough to say, I've got to call for help as my first priority.
First priority, exactly. You've mentioned now some differences between men and women. What about any influences of race?
Well, race is a big deal. It's a big deal on two accounts. The bigger part relates to education. Studies that sort of look geographically at who gets heart disease and who does okay from it. Certain regions of the country, the Southeast especially, what some may say is the Bible Belt, for instance, Mississippi, kind of traditionally poorer demographic areas. These are parts of the country where people are less educated about risk factor reduction and heart disease. And so we do see a lot more of it in those regions. But more particularly in the black community, the Hispanic community, we have in the black community greater amounts of heart disease, but also greater risk factors, more hypertension, more diabetes, probably more smoking. But yet, those women in those demographics, when they present to their primaries or the emergency rooms with chest pain, they're not taken seriously. There was a great big study that was done. It was in Chicago years ago. The I think it was the American College of Physicians did a meeting, and they hired four actors, a black man, a white man, a black woman, and a white woman. They all read a script. They all had exactly the same presentation of symptoms, and then the physicians at this meeting were then asked to make a recommendation of what to do. All of them had a story suggesting that there might be underlying heart disease. The white males were referred for coronary angiograms or more invasive or aggressive treatment, more than white females, and they were all referred much more than black men and black women. The black women just sort of fell off the map with exactly the same symptoms and with greater risk factors. So I think there's something to be said. I think we need to spend a little bit of time making sure we educate
within your own medical population. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. It continues to happen. Risk factor reduction is bigger in minority demographics, but it is the biggest part of the treatment. Once they have come to see me to have a balloon angioplasty or stenting, it's already beyond beyond time.
Yeah, that's right. That's striking a difference, and we can only hope that the profession itself will pick up, as well as the individuals know how to speak on their own behalf, because that's your other point. I'm certain it will be, say, at all points in time, it's really up to us to stay in the driver's seat of our own health.
We do have to stay in the driver's seat. It is kind of what I tell my mom. When you go to see your provider, your physician, if you don't feel that you've received a satisfactory response, or if the symptoms are not making any meaningful improvement, request another opinion, request a specialist.
Right. Let me take a quick departure to your own personal story, Joseph. The fact, native of Chicago, and you jumped into biology in a medical school. Did you always have in mind that you wanted to be a doctor and that specifically go into the specialties around the heart and the vascular system?
You know, I've actually thought about this on occasion, and I don't know where this came from. It's kind of like one day you wake up and you have an idea, and then the next thing you know, you're on that sliding board and you're there. I think most of us who grew up in the inner cities had an opportunity to see a lot of disease directly and indirectly, and it's hard to not empathize with that. I actually grew up in the days of Marcus Welby, MD, and Dr. Red Duke, and seeing those guys on television, they were, I guess, quasi-role models, probably no more than Gilligan on Gilligan's Island, but nonetheless, you do see that they had an impact in something. So I would imagine that that did have some influence in decisions to pursue medicine.
But then the specialty of the cardiac side.
Actually, I was not initially interested in cardiology. I was initially interested in rheumatology because it was complex. It had all of these bizarro diagnoses that no one understood. I found them very fascinating and easy. And then during my training, I met a cardiologist who I felt was brilliant, but more so because he was an excellent clinician. He listened to his patients. He sat down at their bedside, he touched them, and he used his assessment of patients over and above technology. And I said, that's who I want to be like. If he had been an obstetrician, I would have likely pursued obstetrics.
Yeah.
But that was the goal, to be an excellent provider of health care, but also to have someone who you could emulate that was doing a good job at that.
Yeah, that's right. That role of mentorship, and obviously it sounds like that reflected back in then the time you've spent being an instructor, a professor, you know, adjunct faculty, and then the way you've given back to those that are coming up behind you. Is there anything different than the makeup of the younger generation joining medicine vis-a-vis your own?
I suspect there are slight differences, and it's kind of hard not to incorporate technology into the world of medicine today. I mean, I live with my iPad and my iPhone and the apps that help me do things to make patients better. Before those things, we relied on things like clinical diagnosis, looking very carefully at the patients, using our stethoscopes, very good clinical exam skills, as opposed to now I think some of the newer generation is very easy to say, I don't know what that murmur is, so, or the noise in the heart, so rather than doing things to help unmask it, mm-hmm. I'll just order a sonogram of the heart. We call it an echocardiogram.
Sure.
I don't think it's a bad thing, but I do feel that technology has maybe made us a little bit less sharp on our clinical skills. We do try to maintain that. It's still a big part of cardiology and medicine.
So to maintain your clinical skills at all, that talks about this awareness that we have in the greater world. We mentioned you're now having a daughter. Do you find yourself, though, having to be very careful to turn all those devices off so you can maintain that edge in the awareness space?
Yes, I chuckle because I'm specifically restricted from using any electronic devices at home during dinner time around our daughter in particular. But I think in the office as well, it becomes an easy temptation to say, I'm going to order this battery of tests and just see what the dragnet pulls in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tempting to do. It gives you a real quick answer. But I think that is it's a trap in medicine. It does not necessarily address what the patient's specific problems are. You can find a lot of things wrong with people if you do a battery of tests. It does not necessarily reflect why they came to see you. And in the standpoint of trying to reduce one's risk of heart disease or any other disease, it still relies on listening to the patient, what's bothering them, examining the patient, and looking at them as a whole person.
Absolutely. In fact, funny enough, I mentioned before we came on the air that I was just in your hometown this week, and it was interesting. I had to take four cab rides, and all four of the cabbies they were solely relying on GPS to get me where I wanted to go. Now, I've been to Chicago countless times, and we got lost multiple times, and I almost said to one cab driver, tell you what, why don't you let me drive? I've got a better sixth sense. Turn the GPS off, and we're going to get there. So I think you're right. Every one of us in our day-to-day life now are challenged with, you know, the technology giving us too much information or not keeping a view of what the map is before I deep dive into the streets, and I think that's what you're saying.
It is. It's kind of pulling back to carefully look at, first of all, what is the patient's complaint, not what the doctor wants to treat.
Yep.
And then also being mindful of what puts the patient at the greatest risk, making that a priority.
That's great. Well, well put. Again, for those interested, you can learn more about Dr. Joseph Chambers and his work at the Carondelet Health Network by going to carondelet.org. And again, this is in support today. We've invited him to come on about the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women Luncheon that's locally sponsored by Carondelet. It's going to be at Lowe's Ventana Canyon Resort on Friday, October 28th from 9 to 1:30. Tickets are available at 795-1403. Thanks so much for taking the time. He does have his scrubs on, folks, so I know he's going right back into the action. So thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Laura. I am going back to work.
There you go. Thanks so much. Take care.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.